chair here and start with the questions. I want to ask, my question is directed to Alex. You know, the RAC is now considered as a good area where we can introduce stochastic optimization. And this is becoming very important when we start to have a lot of renewables. So you cannot do it in the day-ahead market, but you can do it in the RAC, introduce uncertainty and optimize with respect to that. Folding it into the day-ahead market kind of takes away this opportunity of doing stochastic or robust optimization. And the other question is, from the point of view of pricing, you would think that the pricing effect of the RAC is actually reflected through the virtual transactions that are in the day-ahead market, which kind of pretty much anticipate what the RAC is going to do. So I don't see much value of having a separate pricing run if you have a virtual trading.
Okay, great questions. With respect to the first one, I agree. One of the things that we are looking into is that indeed, if you integrate the two functions, you forego the opportunity to do stochastic optimization in Iraq, which is becoming more and more important in light of the presence of massive penetration of renewables. So I agree, this is a problem, so it needs to be evaluated. Actually, we had discussions with the ISO about this. The ISO is proceeding, as you know, or you may know, being in the surveillance committee, that is proceeding with the Iraq integration with the day-ahead market. Also, other ISOs are very interested about this too. So, but you're right, a negative aspect of that is we forego the stochastic aspect that we could put in Iraq. In terms of the virtual bids, to me, this is even a more important discussion. In the formulation we have so far, indeed, we have not included virtual bids yet. Actually, in the next formulation, that when we submit a paper like this for in the transactions, we plan to address this issue in more detail. Let's see all the issues that relate to the virtual transactions may anticipate what happens in Iraq. I'm not in a position right now to tell you exactly how the virtual bids would interplay with RAC, but this is an area that we have addressed in our paper that it is in your proceedings, but we have not answered that question. But it is part of the ongoing research, so it's a very important issue.
Hello, I'm Nikos Hatzergiri from NTUA. I'm not sure if it is the same question, but I guess the RAC depends on the deficiency or the difference you have between the forecasted load and the actual load. So how do you define that in the day ahead? Do you assume certain error or?
No, it's the difference, not the forecasted versus actual. It's the difference between forecasted and bid-in load demand. At 10 a.m., when the gate closes and the bids come in, you have all the offers at bids from generators and loads. So at that point, you know exactly what is the bid-in load in the system. So you know, for example, that you have, let's say, for California system, 40,000 load bids come in that amount to 40,000. At the same time, the ISO has done a forecast for the next day's peak. At the peak for tomorrow, based on the load forecasting function, is 55. So we have a difference of 15,000 megawatts. That's the scary part, how you cover that gap. So the motivation is that you need a function after the day-ahead market closes to cover the ISO with additional commitment to meet next day's peak. And this function is a result, basically, of the California energy crisis. We didn't have that at that time. So we're going into real time without having a backstop reliability function to have enough committed units to mix next day's peak. Now, the key question is why the bid-in load demand could be so different from the forecast. These are market participants. They do their own forecasts. Why then they under forecast so much? There are many, over the last 10 years, we have studied all sorts of games. This could be a result simply of a load forecast, but we're more concerned about some more gaming going on here, that many participants may decide to under bid, even though they have load for 10,000 maybe, but they submit 9 in order to submit the remaining in real time, do other scheduling if they are chasing, let's say, lower prices in real time. So there is strategic bidding that may be going on, and that explains sometimes the gap between the bidding load and the forecast. So that's the gap that RAC tries to cover.
Out of Wisconsin. As you know, one of my views is that the lack of virtual bidding was one of, perhaps the main reason for the crisis, the fact that you couldn't achieve convergence.
No, it was not the main reason, but Fernando is not the main reason.
I said it's my opinion, okay. That's one of the main reasons, okay. Not the main reason. Yeah, okay. So without addressing the problem of virtual bidding right up front, you're going to have a problem still. But my question really is about, have you done any experiments, and do you have any idea how different would the numbers be in the prices that the day-ahead markets will see with the RUC versus the more conventional approach? Are we talking 5%, 10%, or are we talking occasional situations where the difference are huge and most of the time it doesn't make any difference?
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's a good question. We have done some testing for large ISOs. The difference depends on the conditions. It actually depends how big the gap is. But as you know, the commitment costs of the RAC units are being charged to the market participants that cause the deviation. So there is an incentive, there's a feedback loop in the market for the participants to be close to their actual demand. So that minimizes the gap. But if that gap is high, then the price differentials could be high. I have seen differentials even 10% in some cases. But if you look at the mature markets in the East, for example, let's say New York ISO or PJM, then you see that gap may require the commitment of, let's say, 10 units. Let's say maybe it's 3,000-4,000 megawatts. So if we assume that that's the gap we're talking about, then the price differentials are not very high. But clearly, we can show that if you integrate, the energy prices, the ancillary prices will be lower. But the commitment cost could be higher because the commitment is changing.
One of my great suggestions, I don't know about it.
Please on the microphone, too.
Oh. One of the suggestions that I once made that nobody took me seriously is that instead of the gap, they should allow the ISOs to submit virtual bids. Then you can test the performance of the ISO based on if they made money at the end of the year or they lost money.
Yeah, well, that's a great question, Samuel, I'm sure. It's not that nobody took you seriously, but everybody takes you seriously. But the issue is that if you allow the ISO to be in that business, it's changing the role of the ISO, right? The ISO, well, I understand it's a price taker, but we don't want to be the ISO to be influencing the market. The ISO is a neutral party, should not be taking positions.
Independent.
I'm sorry?
Independent.
Okay, but George, independent. But you know, in terms of the mechanics, what Shmuel is saying is a very good suggestion. Simply, in my mind, it violates the role of the ISO. Of taking positions in the market, and we don't want to do that. Now, if we could change the role of the ISO, this is something that certainly it's a welcome and a very important suggestion that could help.
At the yes. end of the year, you could see they make money by arbitraging the real time and the day ahead market. Then you know that they were doing well. If they lost money, it means they were overly conservative.
Sure, I understand. Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
Michelle.
Yeah, Michel Chertkov, Los Alamos. I have a question to the speaker, Emmanuel, right? Very nice work, and my understanding is that you're doing distributed optimization, right?
Yes.
So it's right. And in doing so, you have local measurements, which are consumptions or generation, right? So that's what you're accounting in the scheme. So that's only observable which you have, correct?
Not exactly. What I have is simply
you cannot hear you.
Okay, sorry. That's on? Okay. So what I have is specific values, not measurements. It's the results of the optimization problem, the optimization subproblem results that are exchanged between market
right.
participants.
No. That's I understand. But your measurements is are those consumptions and generation, right?
Yes.
So now my question is, if you additionally measure voltages or flows through.
I know, voltages are taken into account. So
are you counting them as a result of your, cyber solution, or is it something which you measure and plug in? So that's my question. There are various ways how you can do it.
What I have is the full AC equations. That includes both power, active and reactive, and voltages, magnitudes and angles. So these are within the optimization problem. It's they're all optimized together and solved together. So I don't know if this answers your question.
Well, no, I understood that. But you can either get those as a result of a solution, or you can measure them. If you measure them directly, so that's additional information that you can use, and you can converge faster, that type of things.
But essentially, this is something that runs there's nothing to be measured because this is something run computationally. So
I am asking if you add that analog thing additionally to your computations, if you measure, can it help you? Can it converge faster? Can you stabilize prices faster? So that's what I'm asking.
Implementing the iterations. You see, the iterations are done in the computer.
And
so
I'm asking if you can do.
So what you're suggesting is that you can actually do the iteration physically.
Exactly.
And then measure, but that.
I'm asking to mix those. I'm asking if it is possible to mix and if it accelerates.
No, I don't think it's possible to mix those things because if we have demand fluctuating in real time or actually being able to measure that response, then there will be great fluctuations everywhere in the system. So essentially, that's something that should be.
Well, but you are judging by results which you didn't get. So you are saying your reason not because you cannot do it, but because you anticipate this type of behavior. But that's something to be studied, right?
I'm not sure I understand what you're getting to that.
It's okay. We'll take it. We'll take it offline.
We can discuss that.
Related question. I mean, is your method somehow related to the Baldick and Kim method, the paper 97, that basically they did replication of variables by partitioning the network and doing the replication of variables at the boundaries?
Well, replication of variables is more or less a standard method that goes with various decomposition approaches. What I used is a method that attempts to decompose the augmented Lagrangian of the problem. And it's actually a method which whose parallel implementation I haven't seen before fully applied in the power system.
Because the Baldick and Kim did exactly that with an OPF breaking out the OPF into sub-areas and replicating variables.
There are two basic differences from their work. The first is they had a method quite similar to this, but it was implemented in a serial manner. So their formulation that I've done actually enables the method to solve everything in parallel. And the tests they conducted were limited to 3 or 4 areas. So what I've tried to do is go to a much larger number of areas and see what happens.
But they discussed parallelization, though. They talked about parallelization. They did talk about in that paper.
But for the other two methods they presented, actually.
Oh. Okay.
Hi, I'm Dionysis from Purdue, and this is a question for Alex. And it's related to the previous discussion about the ISO being independent.
Yes.
Perhaps you mentioned this, but I might have missed it. So you have a forecast of the load in the day ahead. Who creates that forecast? Isn't it the ISO?
Okay, okay, that's a very important question that we have dealt for years. Actually, it's a very sensitive question because I have dealt with pretty much every ISO in the country. The ISO is responsible for the forecast. The ISO has its own processes, very advanced methodologies. They produce their own forecasts, they use advanced methods, neural networks, they break down this in zones, all ISOs have that, so they do a good job. However, they also get some forecast indications from, let's say, the major utilities. But they are responsible for combining this and coming up with the forecast. Here is the issue. The issue is not what the forecast number the ISO process gives you. The ISO is responsible for reliability first, keeping the lights on, and then is responsible for markets. Therefore, because of their responsibility, they have the tendency to adjust the forecast upwards, even though in violation of operating procedures. In other words, I'm a dispatcher, okay? It's the end of the day, I run the forecast at 5 p.m. There's a heat wave in the valley in California, and I know that the forecast will be going higher and higher. They get a forecast of 50,000. It's natural to say, okay, I jack it up, and I enter into the system 52, even though the forecast gave me 50. So sometimes they try to be conservative by adjusting the forecast to commit more units. It's not money from their pocket. Who pays for those additional units to cover the gap? It's the market. The market, on the other hand, wants to reduce the number of committed units because they are absorbing less costs. They are paying for the commitment costs. So there is a friction between a conservative approach that the ISO follows to make sure reliability is met the following day versus the market who wants to be paying less and less costs. So what we have done as a result of these intense debates, and if you go to this stakeholder process in the US, you will see very controversial and very confrontational discussions between markets and the ISO, how they set up the RAC target, which is exactly your point. So what we have decided to do is, okay, the ISO is conservative, we cannot change that, but if the ISO over-forecasts, it keeps over-forecasting, okay? It's not fair to the market to be allocating all those commitment costs. So we have a two-settlement, two-tier process. There is a certain level of commitment costs who are being charged to the people who cause the gap, the people who under schedule, okay? But if that cost go above a certain level, meaning the ISO is over-forecasting, adjusting the forecast upwards, the additional costs are spread over to the entire market. In other words, the forecast errors really are being absorbed by the entire market. This is the only way we have really to control a little bit the ISO thing, but you're right, there is a tendency under certain conditions to adjust the forecast upwards to commit more units because they think they need them.
That's going to get even more complicated because now they're talking about committing a flexible ramping capability to deal with renewables. And again, it will be the same deal of how do you allocate the cost of flexible ramping to the people that cause the need for
it. Excellent. Ramping. That's right. That's exactly right. So that's how we try to do institutionally. We have an issue with the ISO being too conservative. We try to commit more units. That's the other issue. It's another area that what Shmuel is talking about, that we need to think through how we allocate those costs.
Janusz Bialek, Durham University. Well, I think this whole discussion is grossly unfair to all the other speakers because I'll concentrate on Alex, who dominates the discussion. So I'll just add one more question. Well, it's not a question, it's a comment to this discussion. It seems to me that this discussion is ideological in terms whether the ISO can take position in the market, in the day-ahead market. So just a comment on the British situation. In the GB market, which is not nodal, it's bilateral, but it's regularly a situation that the bids to the balancing mechanism, which is the same thing as the real-time market, based on the balancing mechanism, are either higher than lower than the forecasted demand. And what National Grid does regularly, it runs its balancing mechanism, which is an auction, to meet the forecasted demand, which is they take position, because at the end of the day, it is their responsibility to balance the market. And the cost of those imbalances are charged through imbalance charges, so-called auto charges, to the participants which got it wrong, which means there's a difference between what they bid and what they actually, what their actual physical
but they
position.
Are for profit and it's for
that's
profit.
Exactly right.
Sorry?
They are for profit.
So, well, but that's why that charge imbalance, right. The imbalance yeah. cost. So what I'm saying is that, well, there are examples in the world when actually ISO takes position in the market and basically balances the system on what it is.
In the US, this is a violation of the most important principle of keeping the ISO independent. Otherwise, the ISOs create winners and losers, and they have no place in the market. That's a very important principle in the US design. And by doing what you're saying, you violate that principle. So,
but it works.
It works, and yeah,
it works for whom? Works for whom?
It works
the question,
for the market.
Okay, now it's getting ideological.
Well, you started from the principle of the lights going out in California. The lights haven't gone out in, despite all the flaws of the British market. It's very reliable.
Okay.
Well, let's.
Yeah. Let's.
Claude, you can answer. Yeah. University of Waterloo.
All right.
Canada. Again, following with the discussion and picking on Alex. Yeah.
It's a fair game.
Looking at the model in your paper for the combined day-ahead market and the RUC of ROC, it looks very much similar to the unconstrained real-time market that we have in Ontario. Basically, where they clear the market with all these constraints without the transmission constraints, and they do this every 5 minutes. What I was trying to understand is, by the way, in Ontario, the day-ahead market is a joke. It's not binding, so it's basically on the books, but it doesn't quite work. However, what I was trying to understand is, what would be, because you said that might have some complexities in solution.
Yeah.
If I understood, from the experience in Ontario. That hasn't been the case. I mean, the model's very similar, works fine. The problems are other type of problems. That's one of the comments and questions. The other question I had is, in the case of Ontario, the loads don't really bid. I mean, it's a fraction of the load. So the forecast is basically what defines what the load should be and what you should be supplying, which is fairly accurate. If you look at the ISO website, they don't deviate more than 5% in the worst of cases.
Mm-hmm.
So, in that context, how do you see this working when you have a fairly accurate load forecast? Thanks.
Yeah. Well, maybe there is a miscommunication here. The RAC is not really like the real-time market. Actually, I was involved in the design of the market in Ontario with ABB for many, many years. I'm very familiar with that market. The RAC is really a day-ahead function that includes full transmission. It's a commitment. It's not dispatched like on a five-minute basis, where clearly is a process that has been fully vetted, and we know exactly how it works and where the problems. And indeed, it works very well in Ontario and in many other places. This is a day-ahead process with full transmission, part of the co-optimization of all the day-ahead commodities, meaning energy, ancillary services, transmission at the rack capacity. So everything is in day-ahead with full transmission at full unit commitment, at full of co-optimization with energy and ancillary services.
The second part of the load.
Yes. Go ahead.
When you don't have a bidding load.
Yes.
The second part was what happens when we don't really have a bidding load, when your forecast is fairly accurate?
Again, the RAC clears. The only similarity between RAC and real time is that they both use the load forecast to clear. The day-ahead market uses the bidding load. The RAC uses the forecasted load. And indeed, in real time, the five-minute market uses the bids, it clears with a load forecast for 5 minutes. That's why I propose to put RAC first in order to maximize the efficiency for the real-time operations, which are more important than the day-ahead operations.
Yeah, but the RAC basically is trying to make sure that if load, some of the load shows up in real time, that there'll be units there turned on to satisfy that.
Yeah.
And that doesn't get reflected, you know, you can have, otherwise you're going to have infeasibility in real time.
Tasos Bakirtsis, Aristotle University of Thessaloniki. I have a short question for Alex and another one for Manolis. Alex, in many North American markets, there is a multi-day rack to commit extra long start units. Is your proposal of combining day-ahead market and multi-day rack, have you considered how to incorporate this integration in multi-day rack? And a short one about the timing requirement, since you have almost double the size of the network, is it within the timing constraints of the market clearing?
Yeah, that's a great question. Indeed, many North American markets, for the rack portion, they go beyond the first day. And they go beyond the first day because it's a reliability function. And they want to look ahead to do the best procurement to meet next day's peak. But how you go to day two and day three is, you saw my time diagram there. I also talk about day two and day three and day four. There are negatives to that. The negatives are the replication of bids. In other words, you solve a problem, but you may create another one because the replication of bids includes errors. Let's say it's Friday. Actually, let's say it's Thursday. So bids didn't come in for Friday. And then you replicate Friday bids for Saturday and Sunday. So how accurate that replication is for a different day type. So replication may introduce some errors. So there are ways to go about it, how to do a develop a better process for replication of the bids. But yes, indeed, we want to go to day two and day three for rack for all ISOs. And this process that I presented here also has the day ahead also go to day two and day three in together with rack to have multi-day. That's the next thing. But our main concern is what errors are introduced by the replication of the bids. Because once you couple 3 days, I'm sorry? Right, but it's even worse, and because then you get into the business of forecasting bids on behalf of market participants. So at least we use their bids, we replicate them, but this replication process introduces errors. So the question is, the benefits from replication supersede some errors introduced from the replication of bids. That's the issue. In terms of timing, this process is now, let's say California, a 5,000 bus system, full unit commitment with rack, you can do it in sequential, you can do it in 15, 20 minutes. This is an amazing performance. Now, if you combine it from the tests that we have done for smaller systems, that actually, if you do the combined versus adding the times for the sequential approach, is even faster. Because remember, the commitment, I don't know if you follow me, because the commitment for the second step locks in the results of the first step, and that lock-in process through penalty functions really has makes that optimization difficult. It's not an easy optimization. Think about it, too many penalty functions, too many must run units, too many hard requirements, so that optimization has a hard time converging, you follow? So if you do it in one shot, it's a much cleaner approach. So we'll do better in terms of timing.
And one for Manolis. There has been some recent literature on consensus-based optimization, which is a distributed way of solving optimization problems without any central information exchange. Do you believe that this kind of optimization could be applied in solving the optimal power flow problem?
The basic issue that I see in this kind of approach is that perhaps transmission constraints might not be very easy to be handled. Perhaps it would be, it's a very simple thing to apply this kind of approach to calculate power imbalance in the network, or perhaps based on that, update the marginal prices and converge the price. But if there are active system constraints, I'm not sure how well, how easy it is to incorporate these constraints into the method.
So there was another paper there which was about transmission cost allocation, and I don't want that paper to be orphaned completely because it was in the wrong session. So my question is that you did talk about counterflows and try to put some kind of consideration. But counterflows are totally a property of the network. They're not a property of a particular participant. So the idea is that when you have a particular entity that causes a counterflow, only happens for that point in time because of the network conditions, but if the dominant flow would go away, that counterflow would become the dominant flow. So how do you plan to take this into account in terms of doing a cost allocation basis for that?
Thank you for the question, and totally agree with the comment. Because of that reason, we used three different approaches regarding counterflows.
I don't think you're talking to the mic. Get the mic closer to you, whichever you like.
Totally agree with the comment, and because of that problem, that is why we considered three different cases.
Use this one.
And because of that subject and of that issues, that is why we used three different ways of considering counterflows. The first way, the absolute one, does not charge counterflows. The second one, the second approach, credits counterflows in case they exist. The last one does not take at all into account counterflows. So we have comparative results, and we study the impact of taking or not taking into account them. So in that way, according to the market, someone can see what fits better to the market needs. Thank you.
Also, the question, do we have time? We have Manolis' paper, which was the last one, and then we had the first paper, and they're two exactly opposite direction topics. So I was wondering if those two speakers could convince each other which way to go. Should we integrate or should we disintegrate?
Okay, I think I'll let them do that over coffee. Thanks, everybody.